Macro Voices is pleased to bring you this encore presentation of an interview which originally aired in full-color video on Real Vision Television at an earlier date. Real Vision is a paid subscription video on-demand channel for finance. In partnership with Real Vision Television, we are pleased to offer Macro Voices subscribers a free trial subscription to Real Vision. To sign up, go to realvisiontv.com/discount/Macro Voices. Macro Voices does not receive any commission or other compensation if you purchase a Real Vision subscription. We are proud to promote Real Vision because we believe they are the only other financial media outlet that shares our values and standards in financial journalism.
This is Aaron Chan of Macro Voices. For this week's Real Vision Television Encore presentation, we bring to you an interview which was originally published on April 4th, 2016, between Grant Williams and Michael Schneider, Chief Investment Officer of Brookline Partners. Now, we've all heard about a potential housing bubble in Australia, but how many have actually gotten into the weeds with a local expert? Well, this is your chance. In an excellent long-form conversation, Mr. Schneider dives through the microscopic residential loan provisions on Australian bank balance sheets and how an investor might profit if the housing bubble were to explode. He also touches on why the next crisis will be different to the linear crisis we had in 2008. Finally, you'll also hear Mr. Schneider's thoughts on the US dollar and how one might position in this current macro environment. Thanks again for listening, and don't forget to take advantage of an exclusive 10% discount on RVTV subscriptions by signing up at realvisiontv.com/discount/macrovoices.
At Real Vision, we like to go to the ends of the earth to find the smartest people we can. And here I am in Melbourne, of all places, to talk to Michael Schneider, the CIO of Brookline Partners. Michael, great to be here.
Welcome to Melbourne.
Yeah, I know. It's a beautiful day out there, despite the curtains being drawn. Now, exactly. You and I were introduced by Bill Fleckenstein a couple of years ago.
That's right. One of my heroes.
Yeah, and one of the great thinkers, I think, in this business. And you and I sat outside a bar in Sydney and had what was supposed to be a cup of coffee and turned into like a two-hour walk through the world. And you know, since then, you and I have chatted regularly, and you're one of those guys that has so many thoughts in his head. And so I want to try and pull as much of that out of you as I can, because I know the audience is gonna love that. So let's kick off with just a little bit of your background, and then I want to get into the things that you're really focusing on right now.
Sure. My career is pretty much based in the bond market. I've been in the Australian bond market for the best part of probably 25, 30 years. And I've worked in a number of different organisations. This is my second startup company, Brookline Partners, with the same team that we'd got together, I think, 10 years ago and set up a different bond firm in Australia. And our kind of premise has always been that we're 1.5% of the world, and notwithstanding how far removed we are, as you've just said, also that 98% of what goes on and impacts our market as an importer of capital, particularly banking and government capital, we have to focus on what's happening in the other 98% of the world. So I'm always looking for threads, connections, and thematic insights that hopefully will help us, one, protect our clients' capital, and two, to hopefully add insight and performance on the back of that.
But this is, you know, Australia's a funny, I've spent a number of years here, and Australia's a funny place in that there are so many smart people down here. You know, people think of it as this little country down the bottom end of the world, but there's so many real thinkers in Australia. I'm always blown away by the quality of thought down here.
There's a lot more Australians overseas than what there is here, I think.
Yeah, that's true.
But I think it's the isolation, or the sense of isolation, that people are always looking outside, because I've found the same thing when I've travelled, that Australians seem to, you know, focus more on the rest of the world because of that sense of isolation. So, I think it is an interesting observation.
Well, let's kick off with Australia. I mean, because it's somewhere that not an awful lot of people know much about the economic situation down here, other than this China boom or what it's done for Australia. But it's an economy that's gone 25 years without a recession,
yeah,
which blows my mind every time I say it out loud. And we're starting to get two camps here in Australia talking about a potential housing crisis, the problems of China. Just talk a little bit about how you see the state of the Australian economy.
It's interesting. It's the way I look at the Australian situation is that we decoupled from the world in 2008, 2009 because of the China phenomenon, China boom. And so from there, you know, we structurally, I think we're very similar to what the Western world was going into 2008, as we were our banking sector, I kind of equate to it as being the machine that should be the oil that moves capital around the system, and our machine, our oil became the machine. And I think we're at a very early stage now of banking and finance within Australia reverting back to being the oil that distributes capital around the system. Banks are about a third of stock market capitalisation. More than half the debt markets issuance is done by Australian banks. So we have a very lopsided structure. I mean, obviously you touched on the mining boom here as well, which is very much struggling at the moment. Our construction sector is okay. The dollar is obviously going to help in the long run against the US. However, our view is that there's a pretty rough ride ahead in Australia. The structural nature of our economy makes us fairly vulnerable.
So that banking sector, I mean, you know, there's what, four major banks here.
Yep.
People worry about how vulnerable they are. You know, to me, it's a liquidity versus solvency issue, yep, like a lot of them are. I mean, it's that the whole the reliance on short-term wholesale funding is perhaps their Achilles heel, but also perhaps the thing that's going to save them, I suspect, if there's any real pain. Talk a little bit about that banking sector, because it's a little different to the ones that most people kind of understand.
Yeah, dollar for dollar, for the most of the last 8 or 9 years, we've been the biggest importer of banking capital in the world. Our banks are, you know, typically within the top 10 to 15 banks by size in the, yeah, world. And so we've got a 24 million person economy, four banks, next to no provisioning, a phenomenal asset boom, particularly in residential housing, that's been also fueled by a lot of external purchases of residential property in Australia. I think the last I saw in Melbourne and Sydney, the average mortgage was 8 times income. Typically, an historical average is around about 3.5 times, three and a half times. And if you kind of, take an economic history viewpoint, I'm always wary that bubbles just don't tend to revert back to the mean. They tend to go through the mean, and at the very least go back to where they started from. In which case, you know, I'd be very concerned that Australian property halves in any kind of credit impairment or change to the credit creation process. And that's where I kind of, you know, look beyond Australia for signs of vulnerability there. And the signs of vulnerability, I think, are more than anywhere else measured in what I refer to as the size of the global balance sheet. In 2007, I think it was, the, you know, notional outstanding derivatives in the world was something like 250 trillion. And at the time, global GDP, I think, was around about 54 trillion thereabouts. So we had a 7 times, you know, kind of notional outstanding derivative scenario that went to 350 trillion in 2008-2009. It got as high as around about 750 trillion on global GDP of something like 72 trillion at the top of my head. You're seeing now that, and it's really started since the Fed, you know, reversed its liquefaction policy in late 2014. You're seeing now the global balance sheet for the first time is shrinking. And I use that term very generically, yeah, but it's how I visualize it. And so the last I saw a few months ago, the size of the global outstanding derivatives is around about 670, 680 trillion. And I think, you know, I was thinking on the way up here how I'd best kind of visualize that. And I can't remember the psychologist who said this, but it was somebody who defined a happy family, and he said, you know, all happy families are happy for the same reasons. All unhappy families are unhappy for very different reasons. And that's how I kind of look at the global balance sheet now. It's going to cause a lot of very unhappy families around the global economy, and it's going to be very uneven as to how that impacts and plays out. And I think, back to your initial point, I think Australia is going to get a very amplified set of consequences from, you know, continued deflation of this global asset.
So recently, just staying on this topic for a little bit, because okay, we've got plenty of time today, which is great. Right. Jonathan Tepper, a friend of mine, put a piece out recently, and the name of the report was "I Know a Guy Who Can Get Things Done." And he and John Hempton, who I'm going to talk to in Sydney, went around posing as a gay couple, following the whole process of buying a house in Australia right the way through. And what they found was shocking, not to me and probably not to you, just because we've seen this bubble appear, and particularly in Sydney and Melbourne. But what I was fascinated about was the reaction to it. You know, this piece made it onto 60 Minutes,
And it was far more interesting.
Yeah.
The reaction was
right.
far more interesting.
And I was watching it from overseas. Obviously, you were here on the ground. But I just saw shadows of 08 and Bernanke's. There's never been a nationwide decline in house prices. But the people outside Australia don't understand how central the housing, the ownership of a house is to Australian culture. What's going on in this housing market? What's the real story? Not from an American overseas, but from an Australian that lives here.
Well, from the perspective of a bank, you know, CBA, for example, 75% of its balance sheet is tied up in residential property.
Right.
Provisioning is almost microscopic within the major banks because you've had this relentless asset price explosion here that's, you know, fueled by offshore buying, fueled by local buying, fueled by this banking and finance boom, which is a big job engine in Australia, fueled by the construction boom, the mining boom. So there's a whole confluence of job engines that have made borrowers more adventurous, made lenders more adventurous, and equally, like any other market, you know, the more markets go up, the more smarter we think we are.
Yeah.
And that's where I think symptomatic of what's happening here is that, you know, if you've got 11 houses and 11 mortgages, then the 12th house makes you even smarter.
Right. But you know, the footage was amazing. But as I say, the reaction to it the next day, and the piece that really struck me was Shane Oliver, the AMP chief economist, who's, you know, is a well-known guy. I mean, he's as well-known as an economist gets down here. And there was a piece in the AFR the next day, and he called Jonathan's claims outrageous. But it was the justification for why it couldn't happen that amazed me.
And the energy behind it.
Yeah, I mean, he's a very smart guy. Mm. He said, it couldn't happen because, and I'm paraphrasing slightly here, essentially he said, in order for it to happen, Australia would have to have a very severe recession.
Yep.
And it's that belief that, well, we've abolished the recessionary half of the business cycle. We can't have that. You know, if that's what you're relying on to stop bad things happening, you're in trouble.
Well, as we saw with the subprime crisis in the US, you know, credit creation processes can collapse under their own weight. And when you look at household leverage now, which is higher than what the US was, it always fascinated me with the US that in the Clinton years before Glass-Steagall was repealed, which is another story of itself, you had... I remember looking at Fannie and Freddie through this process, and it fascinated me that the whole modus operandi of Fannie and Freddie was to put more Americans into their own homes. So getting back to how that applies here, all of that credit creation, trillions of dollars of credit creation that Fannie and Freddie, you know, underpinned, I think generated something like 6 or 7% of an increase in Americans that owned their own house. Within 18 months of the credit crisis in 2008, that had gone back to where it started from. So those 6, 7, 8% of people who were put into new homes, you know, were vaporised very quickly, unfortunately. So I think the same thing applies here, is that you've got stretched psychology, where you've had massive price increases way outside of GDP growth in Australia. You've had massive debt metric increases, such as eight to nine times income in Melbourne and Sydney, and equally the peripheral suburbs certainly in Melbourne and Sydney are now showing signs of impairment. And so when that whole psychology changes, the first place I'll look for is a change in provisioning. And it was interesting because I've had this conversation with Bill Fleckenstein as well, and one of the things, we were watching the subprime crisis like a hawk. We were waiting for that first inflection point that was going to tell us that you can't go from 3 to 5% of total lending to 24, 25%, which is what happened in subprime of all new lending. We were waiting for that inflection point, and we missed it as close as we were watching it. And the first inflection point back then was a slight change in arrears. It was a microscopic change in arrears. And then all of a sudden, you know, it's like Mark Twain, you know, said, how did you go bankrupt? And it was pretty slowly at first and then very quickly. And that's where I think, you know, you'll start seeing it in provision. You are seeing it in bank provisioning now. You're seeing it in a deleveraging of Australian banks. There's a regulatory headwind, as there has been in the US. So you are seeing, you know, in a number of kind of different lights, you are seeing a deleveraging process starting to take hold in Australia that has taken hold in the US and is taking hold in Europe as we speak. It'll have vastly different outcomes in Europe, I think, compared to what it'll have here.
But it's a bit, the question I always get asked, and it's amazing how many people in the last, I don't know, 6 months or so have emailed me and said, you know, you're watching Australia, you're watching the housing market. How do you get short the housing market in Australia? And it's actually interesting when you look at it. It's tough to do, right? It's not. Yeah. You don't have a Toll Brothers or a KB Homes or a, yeah. you know, Lennar. You don't have those nationwide home builders.
No.
I mean, it's all going to come down to these banks because
yeah.
that's the only real leverage anybody's got in this thing, right?
That's a great source of frustration of a lot of friends of mine as well.
Sure.
They haven't got an obvious instrument.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because when you looked at the Wall Street scenario in 2007, 2008, the guys who were shorting it, who were extremely clever, were actually enabling those that were writing the contracts to actually perpetuate this
yeah.
this whole thing they were trying to short. So it was quite a dangerous scenario, which I think is quite understated about the success these people had shorting the housing market.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's step back from Australia because, as you said, you spend a lot of time looking outside Australia, and some of your big picture observations, when I get the chance to read them, are just, I mean, they're just so smart and they're so keen. Just talk a little bit about, I want to talk particularly about the equities bonds relationship and this whole idea of the spreads and where they're going. Just talk a little bit about what you're thinking about, those big picture ideas.
Okay. Oh, thanks for the compliment anyway. But one of the first lessons I learned when I started out on the equity market trading floor about 3 months before the 87 crash, and one lesson that stayed with me from back then till today is that the relationship between debt and equity is not constant. The relationship between debt and equity is very dynamic, and there is a value transfer that occurs between debt and equity holders in prosperous times, and it reverts back to that call option idea of bond holders over equity in less prosperous times. And so what we've had, you know, I suppose since 2008, we haven't had that typical washout where you, bond holders don't get kept whole and then you don't get the bond holders chasing value from equity holders. So you haven't had, for the last 8 years, you haven't had that. And I kind of look at how that plays out is the way I kind of visualize today with 2008 is that I think the last 8 years have been an intermission between credit crises. And I think the next crisis will be vastly different to the last one. It will be far more imprecise because of the fact that that relationship between debt and equity hasn't been allowed to revert back to that cyclical or even secular relationship where value does transfer yeah. between the two holders.
So, that imprecision, I mean, it's a broad question, obviously,
yeah.
but I mean, I understand what you mean, but what does that imprecision look like? I mean, does that just mean this thing could come from anywhere, or do you just think it's going to spread quickly once it starts?
I think it'll spread quickly once it starts. I think that what happened in 2008, what did happen in 2008, you had the Fed that could round up pretty much Wall Street, you know, within an hour or two, sit them around a table and ring fence, you know, whatever problems they had with their balance sheets being overextended. It was quite a precise credit crisis, I think, by any historical standard, certainly more than the 1930s. And we haven't talked about margin lending and all these other peripheral things that will impact the next credit crisis, but it's more imprecise because risk has gone out into the populace a lot more than being contained in Wall Street. And so I think if there is going to be another run, you know, a so-called bank run in the next credit crisis, it'll occur in the mutual fund sector. You know, where we're seeing illiquidity now. If you start seeing redemptions, as we did see in a lot of banks in 2007, 2008, where you did get those banks that were, you know, I suppose shotgun married to each other,
yeah.
The next set of circumstances that will really challenge liquidity, I think, will occur in the mutual fund market.
So what is, I mean, to walk us through how that might unfold, because that's a part of the market that everybody either knows or think they know,
yeah.
But more worryingly, think is rock solid.
Yeah, I think, well, liquidity is a major issue in most asset classes, most asset markets today. And it's interesting because despite all the liquefaction that we've had into markets since 2008, we now are faced with a liquidity headwind. And it's very hard in most government bond markets around the world, it's very hard to get prices to transact. It's almost impossible in a lot of credit markets in Australia and elsewhere. So we've had this, you know, inflated asset boom, to put it very mildly, that now on the other side of that, we've had almost by stealth a change in conditions from expansive to contractive. I talked about the global balance sheet before contracting. But equally, you've also had a scenario where the relationship between debt and equity has both expanded. So asset prices have expanded because debt's expanded, equity's expanded. Both of those scenarios are leveling out now in our view because of the retraction of Fed liquidity. So I look at that as being very much in a low return environment, and even where asset prices are leveling out, I think, at the moment because of change in Fed policy, mutual funds will be now held to more performance criteria. So if you have, you know, if you're a retiree, so you've got the aging demographic, at the very same time you've got a low return world, when returns start going negative or even, you know, close to zero, you start getting extended periods of market correction. We've had 6 or so months of asset market contraction. For that to continue, I just don't see how it doesn't play out in the mutual fund sector. And, you know, you can add ETFs to that as well.
Yeah, I think to me, ETFs is, you know, that to me is going to be ground zero, because I just think there are too many people in those. I mean, they're a bizarre combination between a very sophisticated tool for managing risk and a crap table, basically, that where people can go without doing any research to get long a sector. So that worries me. But I want to talk to you about your idea about lateral and linear thinking, the latest piece you wrote. Talk a little bit about your thoughts there, because it's interesting stuff.
Well, there's two ways I kind of look at it. Edward de Bono did a book called Lateral Thinking many years ago. It was quite influential on me. And again, relating it back to the 08 crisis and what I think will be the next crisis within the next year or two, the 08 crisis was quite a linear crisis. It was very easy to get to the epicenter. You didn't have to join a lot of dots to work out where the problems were. And we comment on that for probably 12, 18 months before it happened. And I remember when we were starting out a business back then, when the Bear Stearns hedge funds got distressed, we had a number of prospects that were talking to us, and they said, oh, there's your credit crisis. And we said, no, this is the start of it. This is not the end of it. And that was quite a linear type crisis, if you will. And, you know, I suppose I use the words precise. This is going to be a far more lateral crisis with a lot more unintended consequences. And, you know, mutual funds, ETFs are one of those areas I think are going to be cause for concern that weren't the problem in 2008. Yeah. And so in terms of how we look at that, we just don't see a scenario where asset prices don't revert back to or even through, you know, historical averages because of this credit creation process. This global balance sheet is shrinking, and it's going to show up in different ways. And you're seeing other headwinds, you know, such as, you know, global trade is slowing down, global capital flows are becoming more constrained, emerging market dollar-denominated debt is becoming more problematic. Each family has their own set of unhappy circumstances, and collectively, you know, it's going to be problematic around the world, but problematic in different ways.
Well, you were seeing stuff 2005, 6 into 7 that you were kind of worried about, but no one else was seeing.
Yep.
What are you seeing now that causes you concern, that again is frustrating you, that people don't seem to be paying attention to? Where are the areas you're looking for those signs?
I mean, I think it's a good question. The psychology, there's probably more of an impenetrable psychology now, because we live in a world where the Fed will come to the rescue. The problems, and one thing, I mean, I wouldn't have predicted the success that the Fed had in saving the system back in 2008. No question they did. But I don't think you can draw a lot of happy conclusions from that when you look at the Fed minutes. You know, they weren't at all diagnostic of what the problems were back then. So if you're of the view, as we are, that the next crisis is going to be very, very different and equally going to be, all things being considered, being worse than the 08 crisis, it's very, very dangerous in our view to think that the Fed, because they saved the system back then for a whole bunch of reasons, they can apply exactly the same tactics. I mean, you look at, you know, bond markets, for example, and this is where the asymmetry of risk is, because you can either look at this from a risk measurement perspective or a volatility perspective. You know, for example, back in 2008, 2007, when treasuries were yielding in the order of 5%, now they're yielding, you know, less than 2%. Now, the dollar volatility per basis point of a bond, 10-year US bond, at 2% is 40% more volatile than it was at 5%. Yeah. So it's not the same thing. At the very same time, you've had this raft of global bond issuance. Governments have been in deficits pretty much everywhere around the world. So bond supply has been increasing. So that tells you that bond benchmarks, or the pool of bonds that are, I suppose, people like me are measured against, are getting longer and longer in duration. Yeah. At the very same time, you've got the volatility of a bond is 40% higher, the typical duration extension of the global pool of bonds is roughly 25-30%, if not more, longer in duration. So you've got a longer bond asset, if you want to distill that into one bond, with a equally a more volatile bond price. Yeah. And so what we look at that and say, you can't measure the risk of a 5% bond with a duration of, call it 1.25 years less than what it is now. It's not the same thing. And so how does that valuation framework, how does a typical valuation framework allow for that? How do you value an equity based on the volatility of a bond? And we kind of talk about that in terms of being a two-dimensional versus a three-dimensional thinker. You can be a two-dimensional thinker, and this is the context of the article, and change one or two variables. But to be a three-dimensional thinker, I think, is the only way of looking at the next crisis. It will be three-dimensional because it's not the same set of circumstances that we had in 2008, and equally how you measure the risk of these instruments, because everything else feeds off a bond yield or it feeds off an interest rate. You've also got a scenario now where you've had a debt-funded buyback boom. I mean, I never thought I'd see in my lifetime that the net inflows of US equity markets is actually negative. Like, equity markets are meant to supply capital, to generate capital. They've actually been in reverse. You know, they've had negative issues. The buybacks have outnumbered new issuance. I mean, it's extraordinary.
Well, there's so many of these extraordinary things. And, you know, what I've found through traveling around and talking to people, you know, and I'm so lucky I get to speak to so many smart people. And within that world of talking to really smart, engaged people that focus, you know, laser sharp precision on financial markets, I'm struck by how inevitable the crisis is to those people.
No question.
Everybody, it's not even up for discussion. It's coming.
Yep.
They'll debate as to when, and they'll debate as to where it might start. And then you step back and you look at the narrative, and you look at the media, and you look at this, and even investment bank research. You know, there's a big piece of coverage on a Morgan Stanley report yesterday where they said there's a 30% chance of a global recession now. Now, that was a shock to a lot of people. But, I mean, the smart money has been placing odds above 30% for a year now. I mean, those guys are up at above 50% now, and some of them think we're already in it. So, you know, at what point do you reach this tipping where the smart money that understand what's going on because they focus on it and the mainstream narrative meet? What happens then? Because to me, I don't see how the central banks, the Fed, together can stop that. I've talked a lot about this. Once that tipping point gets reached, what the hell can they do now?
Well, the slower zebras don't get eaten by the lions, so right. The herd gets slower. And that's exactly what we're seeing in terms of economic growth potential. David Rosenberg wrote a piece on this a few months ago, I think it was, and he said that asset life, average asset life of in the US is something in the order of, I think, the lowest, the old asset ages are the oldest since 1958. So you've had this hollowing out of the business sector in, you know, the most vibrant capitalist economy in the world, through debt-funded buybacks, through debt-funded dividends, through hollowing out short-term thinking versus long-term strategic thinking. You've then got the slower zebras not getting eaten by the lions. So then you have incredible lack of economic efficiency. So the platform for recovery, when bondholders get kept whole, when equity emboldenedness is unimpinged, then you get a scenario where growth potential is very, very muted. And so what I think has happened, the price that we're starting to realise now, at least in our belief, is that we're paying the price for this zero interest rate policy, where, you know, you have a lot of zombie companies, zombie economies, where you can't grow your way out of it. Charlie Munger says that we can grow our way out of our problems in America at 2% growth. I'm not so sure about that, because I think the economic efficiency you get on the other side of that, and you're seeing that in the productivity numbers. Of course, when you start seeing inflation coming through, then non-economic speed limits of these developed world economies are going to be unable to withstand, you know, a high velocity of inflationary pressure. Now, that might look like a silly thing to say now in such a benign global economy where, you know, a third of the world's bonds, I think, are negative yields at the moment, where you pay somebody to look after money on your behalf. all of these things. You know, I'm sure my grandchildren will come up to me and say, that, you know, what were you guys thinking back then? But where I think we need to be very cognizant of is that we have this hypersensitivity to a changing in circumstances. And I think it's not just the global balance sheet that we're seeing it in. We're seeing it in global trade. We're seeing it in restrained capital flows. We're seeing it everywhere except in this impregnable psychology. But I think that's coming. And I think in Australia, getting back to your earlier point about banks, provisioning doesn't need to move a hell of a lot to really start impacting the credit creation process here, which will impact housing prices here. And you only need, as you say, we haven't had a recession in 25 odd years. As soon as we get our next recession, then you'll see it coming through in the labour market, and that's when it'll gather velocity. So, but I think this whole idea that we're through the worst of this, I think it's actually during this, you know, what I would call an intermission between 08 and today, you know, for the first 4 or 5 or even 6 years, you had an expansiveness of conditions. And then a couple of years ago, the Fed decided to withdraw from the liquidity markets. You're seeing it in repo markets now. One of the things that fascinates me, and this is where markets as a signaling mechanism, which I put in the piece as well, markets as a signaling mechanism aren't giving you the same signals. And a good example is you've got, with the exception of the US, but most other places around the world, government bond yield curves are flat, credit yield curves are steep and getting steeper. So the term structure of credit interest rates is becoming tighter, credit spreads are widening, and swap curves are inverse in many places in the world. So you've got three different yield curves telling you three different things. And this is where you have to pay attention to these things.
But amidst all that, you've got three different yield curves telling you three different stories. You've got to invest in that environment. Yep. How do you do that? Practically, how do you do that?
I think you have to be a lot more tactical today than what you perhaps did in 2008, even 2009, 2010. I think it is a much more tactical world. I think it's interesting to trade the psychology of the market a bit more now. Like in Australia, I think in the last few weeks, you know, we've gone from 2.5 easings, I should say, tightenings, I'm coming from the wrong era,
yeah, right.
2.5 easings being priced into our local bond market. And now there's less than one easing priced in the bond market. The economy hasn't changed at all. And I can't remember who said it. It was quite a salient point that markets as forecasters are far more volatile than the underlying economies they're trying to predict. And so we're very, you know, much more cognizant of that today. We think it's much more of a tactical market. And again, you know, liquidity is really important to us. So if we are going to get involved in credit, it'll be at the front of the curve and it'll be very, very liquid. But I think that the swap phenomenon is something that intrigues us as well. I think that all the regulatory explanations that I've heard both domestically and abroad don't hold weight. I think that, you know, the most credible view that I've heard on that is that the timing of this swap inversion doesn't coincide with the regulatory.
Well, talk a little bit, because this is something that you wrote about, what, 6 months ago now, I guess?
Yeah, a few months ago, yeah. I can't remember when.
Maybe not quite six, but
yeah.
And it was fascinating. But there are going to be a lot of people that haven't paid attention to this. So just walk through this, because this is, to me, this is a big story and it's ongoing and it's something's happening and no one really knows what.
Well, you've had the explanations that I've heard for the swap market, you know, scenario unfolding where swap curves have either gone through or even inverse to government bond markets. In other words, saying that government bonds are more riskier than an interbank effective implied swap rate doesn't hold water for us. And so the two explanations were that the regulatory framework means that you have to hold more capital against swaps, so therefore it's not the same disintermediation tool that it's been in the past. And yet at the same time, you've had corporate credit issuance declining over that time. So to me, the two scenarios don't add up. You can't have credit issuance declining at the very same time you're saying, well, there's a restraint to using swap as a tool of disintermediation. The thing that does intrigue me, and the best explanation I've heard for this, is that this swap movement broadly coincides with Japan exporting its balance sheet, the latest version of Abenomics. And so, and even the timing of the markets in recent weeks and even the last month or two of that swap market retracting, certainly here and a few other places around the world, to me that really does coincide with the yen depreciation and the Japanese balance sheet being exported.
So, but where does this go though? Because Japan, you know, the more we go down this road, the more it seems to me that Japan is going to be the flashpoint. Somehow Japan is going to be the thing that doesn't work anymore and blows this whole thing up. And I cannot for the life of me work out where it's going to happen, whether it's the currency, could be the banking sector. I don't know. But with what you see in the ECB, everybody's following that Japan playbook. So the more you think about it, the more you realize, okay, well, watch the guy in the front, because he's the guy who's going to fall in the pothole first, and then you can try and avoid them. But I mean, do you see that, or do you see that maybe from your perspective down in Australia, there's another place that we should be looking for them?
Yeah, I think you're right. It's at the front of the queue, but I think it's the secondary effects that will bring things undone. It's the impact on the US dollar. It's the impact on emerging market US dollar denominated debt. So I think it will come back to the importers of capital rather than the exporters of capital. The exporters of capital, such as Japan, are disturbing the market through the US dollar to the importers of capital. So I think the flashpoint will still come from the importers of capital. And so, you know, married up to that, you've got, you know, this Chinese anti-corruption drive, Operation Fox Hunt, Skynet. You know, they're very real. And it's a thematic trend that the global capital markets have really thrived and survived on for the last 8 years that is now showing signs of going into reverse. You know, we were led to believe by a lot of commentators that $4 trillion of foreign reserves are going to be more than enough of a buffer, you know, to save China and therefore the world from any, you know, air pockets that we might get into capital markets. Well, that's proving not to be the case. And in fact, it's proving to be problematic in terms of the diminished size of their foreign reserves. You know, there's two other times in history when excessive foreign reserves have proved to be very much a turning point. And one of them was in 1929 in the US when they had massive foreign reserves, and the other one was 1987, 88 in Japan.
But I mean, that 1987, 88 Japan thing, I was living there then. And so, you know, we saw that up close, even though we didn't know what we were seeing, we saw it up close. But that feels almost like a terminal decline now. I mean, that was the tipping point for a decline that has gone on for 25 years. And with the demographic situation, yeah, in Japan and their complete aversion to any kind of immigration to solve that problem, it feels terminal to me.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's a three arrows policy. I think there is some cognizance or recognizance of that in Japan now. The demographic is clearly a lesson for the Western world to take notice of, and particularly with, you know, such a low return, low bond yield environment in the West. I think the demographic is something to be very, very aware of in terms of Japan, because I think it gets to a point where I don't think an immigration wave would save that now.
No, I don't think so either. So what about the US dollar? I mean, you touched on it just then. I mean, it seems there's two camps. There's, you know, Rao's stronger for longer forever camp, which there's a lot of smart people in, and the evidence is pretty compelling. And then there's the other camp that says we're at or near the end of this run, and people are going to wake up and realize it for what it is. Where do you see the dollar?
I see the dollar as, you know, probably the tallest pygmy in a currency world. And really, I think what we're seeing in repo markets, swap markets, in collateral markets in general, and it's really this whole idea of collateral, you know, the pool, again, a different way of looking at what I call this global balance sheet, is really the size of global collateral markets. And that's gone into reverse in the last couple of years. And I think that's more the most important thing that we need to focus on. So where I sit on that is that I think implicitly the price of the US dollar is reflective of a shortage of US dollars for those who really need US dollars, yeah, particularly US denominated debt. And so I don't have an outright fundamental strong view on the US dollar, but I do think that this is reflecting what's happening in collateral markets, is reflecting a greater demand for US dollars.
So where do we go? I mean, we're sitting here, we see all this structural weakness everywhere in the world. We see central banks seemingly in a coordinated fashion right now. It looked like they were all going to kind of go their own way for a little while, and I think they're all scared now, so they want to kind of huddle together. What's next, do you think? Where do we go from here?
Well, a different way of saying the same thing is you look in Italy, for example, where, you know, I think, is it arrears, loans in arrears are something like, is it 19% of GDP?
Yeah,
it's just extraordinary. These things are very blunt economic forces, and they can't be turned around very quickly.
So why don't they matter? Why don't they seem to matter to anybody? Because, you know, that number, at some point, we both know that 20% is going to matter to people.
That's right.
What are they looking past now?
Well, I think the psychology is still that debt holders will be kept whole. And I don't think there's any narrative, as you would put it, that suggests that that is going to be the case. I haven't seen a central bank that is, you know, committed to keeping bondholders whole anymore. And I don't think it's a banking and finance. I think you could keep bondholders whole in 2008 under the idea that it was a banking and finance problem. This isn't a banking and finance problem anymore. It's just a general asset boom problem that has been fueled from a banking sector that is now deleveraging, that is now subject to a far more onerous regulatory regime. And so the amount of collateral, and I think what is going to be interesting from here on in, I think there's two ways of looking at it, and both of them, I think, intrigue me in terms of how Berkshire Hathaway have approached this. You know, this whole idea of Berkshire Hathaway is that you can evolve, you can have the same investment ethos, but you can evolve your thinking. And there's two areas about Berkshire Hathaway that are almost inconsistent with each other. One is their acquisition of shares in IBM. And if you look at IBM, I think since 2004, they've bought back about $116 billion of equity. So it's almost like a giant zero coupon bond.
Right.
And so you can buy IBM on the basis that it's a big zero coupon bond. I think 92% of their profits, I think, have been subject to share buybacks since 2004. Or then you can look at a scenario where, you know, capital intensity is much more important in valuation frameworks. And where I think that's particularly interesting is when they bought BNSF. I was at the Berkshire AGM, I think, 3 years ago, and Munger, you know, said that we were shown that deal 10 years before we took it, and it took us 10 years to understand how valuable it is to us, apart from scale, of course. And if you are seeing, you know, a shrinkage of this notional, you know, global balance sheet, if you are seeing a deleveraging of the global banking system, if you are seeing a re-regulatory regime where banks are reverting back to being utilities or reverting back to being the oil that moves capital around the machine, then this capital intensity reflects what will be, in my view, a shortage of capital. You know, everyone talks about this savings glut. Everyone talks about this whole idea that, you know, you capital just, you know, grows on trees, and therefore, you know, asset valuations can be justified at the recent levels of the last couple of years. I don't think that's the case for a minute. I think, you know, the idea of BNSF is that unless somebody replicates that whole capital infrastructure right next to their own, unless they put railway tracks next to them and the same rolling stock that they've got, their barrier to entry, their moat, is their capital intensity. Whereas we've had this 70-odd year consumerism boom that has gone way out over the ledge, you know, really Glass-Steagall being repealed, I think, you know, again, isn't talked about enough as to how much over the ledge we got,
yeah,
how global leverage was aided and abetted by that. And we've had a tech boom since then, we've had a mortgage boom in the US since then, we've had, you know, a rolling series of asset booms, you know, since Glass-Steagall was repealed. And so I think if we are going to see a retraction, a shrinkage of the global capital base, which I do believe we are, I mean, savings gluts are really a reflection of the levels of debt that are in existence around the world. So I think there's not much of a distinction made between savings and debt. But I think how you can look at it is you can either, you know, take two approaches. Look at those companies that are shrinking their own balance sheet, and at some point that won't work anymore for IBM or anyone else. You know, the mathematics don't allow that to continue ad infinitum. Or you can look at capital intensity, because in the last 70 years, we've had this, you know, credit boom where, you know, you had, for example, you know, in the 30s, you had Westinghouse, you had General Motors, all these companies set up vendor financing schemes to move their products. The vendor financing schemes eventually lowered the cost of capital for those borrowers. And you really had 60 years of financial disintermediation that went on and allowed the fluidity of capital and credit creation to enable a vibrant banking and finance boom. One of the other things that really fascinates me is the period in the 50s when the dividend yield in the US and the S&P 500 went through the treasury yield. I remember Byron Wien wrote a piece on this at least 10 years ago. I've still got a copy of it somewhere. And he said that he'd only just joined the industry when that happened, and all the guys on the desk were saying, well, next month it'll go back the other way. I think it was 53 years later that it actually went back the other way. So for 50-odd years, you had a scenario where equity dividends, now equities are riskier than debt, so the return should be greater. And the argument of Berkshire Hathaway was that the reason equity yields went through bond yields was because management can compound returns better than you can as a bondholder.
Right.
And that holds true until the credit system collapses under its own weight in 2008. And those things work until they don't. And that's the corollary, or that's the caveat to that. And now we're seeing a scenario, mind you, if you'd have caught that wave as Berkshire did for the best part of 50 years and other people did, then a lot of your investment mistakes were very much muted or mitigated. And I think now that equity yields have gone the other way in the last few years, I think that's telling you from a completely different direction that valuation frameworks have to change. The shape of yield curves matter a lot more now when bond yields are very, very low because of that, you know, volatility.
Well, yeah, to your point about volatility, yeah. I mean, that idea of mitigating mistakes, whether it's deliberate or whether the market bails you out,
yeah,
almost besides it, in spite of yourself, that to me is perhaps the crucial point, because we've reached the point now where it's tough for you to be bailed out. There isn't a political will for institutions to get bailed out.
Definitely.
We have another problem. And that volatility and that margin compression suggests that the market's not going to bail you out either.
No, and you don't have 5% to play with in terms of interest rate policy either. So the starting point for this is, you know, very flat yield curves, flat to inverting yield curves around the world in government bond markets, very steep credit curves telling you an entirely different story about the credit creation process. The government bond curve, we look at it as seeing, as revealing the outlook for economic growth, which is benign, which is kind of intuitive, I think, economic potential, you know, the age of assets, all of these things, the lack of productivity, all of these things are suggesting a very benign economic outlook, but credit conditions are revealing, you know, vastly different scenarios. So when you're coming off a base of, you know, a 1.8% US Treasury yield, there's not a lot of room to play with, and any mistakes will be amplified from here. So, and you don't have, you know, the will, as you say, to bail everyone out. I firmly believe that.
So, I mean, Aussies are naturally sunny people by their disposition. Are there any bright spots that you're seeing that you think, you know, okay, here's somewhere where you can put capital to work that gives a much better risk return?
Yeah, I think there's going to be a heck of a fire sale on the other side of this.
Yeah, well, that's the problem, right? To me, that's the problem, because everything's relative now. And so people will say, oh, you know, look, this doesn't look so bad.
Yep.
But you have to step back and say, but try and picture it all amidst whatever smoking embers there are. There's going to be so much more to buy for your money.
Yeah, there will be. And again, it's that relationship between debt and equity that I think is really important to consider as well, is that, you know, the first lesson I learned is that, you know, in distressed equity times, bonds behave like equities, and or hybrid instruments behave like equities, whereas you want to create exposures that are the opposite of that, where you're saying, well, you want an equity to behave like a bond in distressed times, and as opposed to a bond behaving like an equity in distressed times. You need to be on the other side of that trade. It's not an easy thing to pull off. It's an easy thing to say. But I do believe there's going to be a hell of a fire sale on the other side of this. So you're right, there are sunnier Australians than me out there. But equally, you know, the great investors that I've followed and have influenced me are far more defined by the air pockets they avoid and keep that magic of compound interest going. We're in a low return world, there's no denying that. But equally, I think if the global balance sheet shrinks, then debt and equity will both shrink concurrently. So I think you need to be exposed to assets as opposed to debt or equity instruments that can at least mitigate that shrinkage. And again, this is where I get back to capital intensity. I think, you know, assets that are capital intensive, I think are going to be, you know, far more attractive than this return on equity culture that we've really had for the last 70 or 80 years. You know, I mean, a constant volatility 10-year bond in the US in 1946, I think had a face of $101. And I think in 1981, the face was $17. So you can get destruction, wealth destruction by stealth over a long period of time. And that's where I think, you know, debt and equity markets have expanded. They are showing signs of contracting, and we think that will cause a whole new set of behaviours going forward.
So, Michael, before we wrap up, there's one thing you touched on earlier, right at the beginning of this, and it's been rattling around my head ever since, and that's psychology. Because, you know, to me, that's the game now. That psychology, when that changes, I don't think there's anything that anybody can do to change it. Talk a little bit about how you see the market psychology now and whether it's different now than it was in 08 or 87 or 98?
I think it is different now, and I think it's different because volatility is defined by VIX or other indicators is one set of volatilities. The other volatility is changes in investor responses. And I think we've had a ringside seat at this in the last 6 or 8 months. I think underneath, you know, a fairly impenetrable market psychology where the Fed's got my back and, you know, everyone gets bailed out and everyone lives happily ever after, I think there have been windows and pockets over the last 6 or 8 months in particular where for moments the markets don't necessarily believe that with the same conviction. And that's why I think, you know, certainly from our point of view, that trading the psychology of markets, the forecasting abilities of markets is effectively what we're trading, is going to be far more important than underlying fundamentals. And that's where I keep coming back to valuation frameworks. You know, the lens that we look at these set of circumstances today where the credit creation process by any definition is shrinking, you know, the deleveraging, the regulatory environment, liquidity, all of these things are going the wrong way for a continued asset boom. And so, you know, we're, you know, making sure that, you know, where asset prices shrink, we're, you know, less exposed to those that are, you know, more leveraged, for example. You know, I think this whole deleveraging, you know, you can't deleverage the banking system without deleveraging the global economy. It's nonsensical to think that you can do that.
So that psychology, in 08, we saw a massive shift in psychology, but everything was done, everything possible that could be done to affect that psychology was done. And it worked. I mean, let's be honest, it worked. What differences do you see between 08 and what you think might be happening at some indeterminate point in the future?
We're heading towards more price discovery, I think, and that's why the mutual fund sector does concern me, particularly the more illiquid parts of the mutual fund sector. It's not a case of bonds or equities. You know, we think that if we are getting, you know, a kind of retraction in credit creation, which means to a retraction in asset prices, then it's not an either or scenario. But I think what has scared markets and scared a lot of participants in the last 6 to 8 months has been this idea that we are seeing some signs of price discovery that we didn't see in 2008. It was pretty much a V-shaped bounce in many ways. There were some casualties, as we know, but there weren't too many of them. The counterparties were kept intact. The dominoes were kept intact. Now, I think, you know, there have been a few examples where markets have been pretty scared of price discovery.
When we discover prices, what are we going to find?
Well, there's not a lot underneath it. There's a lot more sellers than buyers. And that's the issue is that, you know, fundamentals don't support valuations as a general comment. Bond yields are far more volatile, or bond prices, I should say, are far more volatile today. So the underlying driver, which is an interest rate assumption along asset prices and valuations, aren't going to be there to support on a fundamental basis. You know, it's a very non-fundamental world that I think we're about to enter into. And I think we've shown signs of that in the last few months, that this next world is not a fundamental world that we're heading towards.
Michael, it's a good place to leave it. I have a feeling that you and I are going to continue this conversation at regular intervals in the future. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Pleasure. Thank you.